Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by Menlo Park Dental Excellence, providing general dentistry with quality care to all patients, serving patients one at a time with no triple booking, flexible hours Monday through Saturdays, mpdentalexcellence.com.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, the new budget mantra in Sacramento, restraint. How Governor Brown has tempered expectations of Democrats. Plus, why Filipino veterans of World War II hope immigration reform will help reunite their families.
The Filipino-American families cherish the possibility of being reunited, so it still is part of the American dream for many of these families.
Also, a youth orchestra in Fresno converts mariachi music into classical compositions.
I want the audience to feel free to stand up and dance. There's a place where they get to yell and just have a really good time, because isn't that what music really is about? Isn't that what really attracted everybody to music in the first place?
It's the California Report. Well, there's an old saying that you can't spend money you don't have. But over the past decade or so, that hasn't stopped California governors and legislators who often use budget gimmicks and fuzzy math to make the books look balanced. But a funny thing happened in Sacramento this week when Governor Jerry Brown and Democrats in the legislature agreed to a budget that spends less than the state might actually take in.
In general, I think prudence rather than exuberance should be the order of the day.
That's Governor Jerry Brown's description of it, and joining us now to give us his take, Sacramento Bureau Chief Scott Detrow. Scott, first of all, the legislature passed the final version of the budget Friday. Any last-minute surprises or changes?
No, this is a plan that we've known about for about a week now. It just took a lot of time in between that deal being struck by the governor and top legislators on Monday to actually turning that into legislative language. There are a lot of so-called trailer bills being passed today as well. Those are bills that have hundreds and hundreds of pages in them, but we didn't really see them until the last day or so. So there's some grumbling about that from Republicans, but by and large, we're seeing a lot of party line votes here in Sacramento, bill after bill after bill, and all of these make up the budget.
And the big winner, of course, the schools. But who else? Who made out well in this budget?
Schools certainly did come out ahead in this budget. As part of the education restructuring that Governor Brown made his top priority, they're going to get more money than they did in previous years, and poorer school districts will get a larger chunk of money than they did before with this formula that directs extra money to districts where more than half of students are either poor or learning English. Another big winner is the court system. California's courts had lost hundreds of millions of dollars in funding over the last few years, as the state tried to close its big deficit. And legislative leaders pushed for about $60 million more in spending on courts than Governor Brown had initially wanted. Chief Justice Tani Kantil-Sakauli had been very blunt in saying that these budget cuts had led to delayed justice, delayed court proceedings. Now $60 million to speed that up a little bit. And finally, social welfare programs. This budget has more money for CalWORKs, for mental health care treatment, for dental coverage and Medi-Cal. And these are all areas, of course, that saw major, major funding reductions in recent years. So now that funding isn't anywhere close to fully restored, but this is the first increase they've seen in a long time.
And Scott, let me just ask you about what the governor was describing there as prudence. You know, given that we've had year after year after year of cuts to programs that Democrats cherish, social safety nets, schools, and so on, why were they so willing to accept the governor's insistence that the budget be based on revenues that were really several billion dollars less than the nonpartisan legislative analyst is predicting?
Because being conservative looks really good for the Democrats in charge here in Sacramento. Ever since the party got control of two-thirds of both the Senate and the Assembly, leadership has been very quick to push the line that that they are fiscally prudent, that giving Democrats this many votes is not going to lead to big tax increases, to big spending increases. And that's why tax bills from soda taxes to oil taxes to cigarette taxes did not advance in Sacramento this year. So both Daryl Steinberg, the top Democrat in the Senate, and Assembly Speaker John Perez were very quick to say, we are being conservative. We are taking the most conservative tax estimate out there this year. We are saving you money. That's something that Speaker John Perez talked about in the very celebratory press conference that three leaders held earlier this week.
The three of us combined have this notion of being very disciplined with resources as they come in and building for long-term recovery and not repeating the cycle of boom and bust and the mistakes of the past.
So Perez and Steinberg did use this lower spending number, but they also laid the track record for these funding cuts to be restored by back-ending a lot of the spending on that. But of course, that does set up tension down the line, or it could at least, because a lot of rank-and-file Democrats are saying, wait a second, we thought that we'd have more tax revenue coming in. Now we're leaving that money on the table. And I can assure you that there will be pushes for higher spending in the next budget cycle because of that.
And Scott, there are a few Republicans up there in Sacramento, few and far between, though they may be. And there was a quote I love from Assemblyman Jeff Gorell, a Republican from Camarillo. He said, it's the mullet budget. It's conservative up front, but it's liberal in the back. Is that a common feeling among Republicans? I'm not even sure what that means, but that criticism that he expressed there.
You don't hear much about mullets these days, that's for sure. The message from Republicans is that this is not some grand economic recovery that we're seeing. This is extra tax dollars coming in because of the tax increase put in place by Proposition 30. And they're worried that because the Prop 30 tax hikes expire at a certain point in time, and because this budget lays the groundwork for increased spending, especially in social welfare programs, that's just going to create another deficit in a few years. Republicans were also pretty frustrated that they were left out of talks. Freshman Republican Assemblyman Rocky Chavez expressed that frustration on the floor during the final debate.
To not even be involved in the process of the budget, to not even know what's in it, to no one even taking the time to say, hey, you know what, I'd like to see what you think. I have a problem with that.
And I guess that's kind of the definition of powerlessness, isn't it, when you've got less than a third of the vote in both of those houses. Scott, one last thing. This week, one of the governor's top priorities got a big boost, the Surface Transportation Board voting 2-1 to give a green light to that first section of high-speed rail between Fresno and Merced. Does that mean we're going to actually see shovels in the ground anytime soon in the Central Valley?
Well, high-speed rail is not quite in the clear. There are still several permits needed, contracts that have to be worked out. There are lawsuits. But this was a pretty important step. This is a federal board which basically ruled that while it does have oversight over this project, it's not going to exercise that oversight for this first stretch of Central Valley Rail. And that saves the project a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of bureaucratic hurdles.
Now they just need a few more $100 billion or so. Scott Detrow, Sacramento Bureau Chief. Scott, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Scott.
Today we begin an occasional series about Californians whose lives would change if immigration reform is enacted. An amendment recently tucked into that package of legislation would put the sons and daughters of World War II Filipino veterans who fought alongside American troops on a fast track to citizenship. As the California Report's L.A. Bureau Chief Stephen Cuevas explains, it's just one of the military benefits Filipino vets have been fighting to win for decades.
At a big Philippine Independence Day celebration in Los Angeles last weekend, traditional dancers, festooned in colorful feathers, capped the afternoon with an explosive tribal dance meant to symbolize the start of battle. A couple of uniformed World War II veterans looked on proudly from the front row as the shield and spear-wielding dancers whipped and whirled across the stage, watching the sky for the Idaw, the mythical hunting bird that is believed will guide warriors to victory.
The Filipinos were offered independence on October 1943 by the Japanese. Filipinos rebelled because we did not like them.
Franco Arcibal is also something of a fabled warrior. He's among the roughly 250,000 former guerrilla soldiers who fought beside U.S. troops during World War II after the Japanese invaded the Philippines.
I was captured. I was tortured severely by the Japanese. They drowned you with water and they shocked me with electricity.
Arcibal managed to dig his way out of that prison camp and avoid execution. His wartime experience left Arcibal's memory and his hearing a little shaky. It also ended up shaking his faith in the American government. The U.S. offered Filipino soldiers full veteran benefits as an incentive for enlisting. It also said they could become naturalized U.S. citizens once the war ended. But shortly after it did end, the benefits were rescinded, something Arcibal didn't even realize until he was denied care at a veterans clinic after emigrating to the U.S. in the 1980s.
My gosh, I risked my life and the Americans say I have no benefit. That's why I devoted my time to work for the return of the benefits that the Filipino veterans lost.
Ever since that day at the clinic, Arcibal's been battling on behalf of Filipino-American veterans. That includes campaigning for legislation proposed by Hawaiian Senator Mazzy Hirono, now among the immigration reforms under consideration in the U.S. Senate. The Filipino Veterans Family Reunification Act would put the children of Filipino World War II veterans on a pathway to citizenship while reducing the long wait for a visa. 86-year-old veteran John Aspiras Jr. knows what that's like. He's been waiting for his daughter's visa to be approved for years.
And, well, as of now, the paperwork is still being processed. You know how it goes with the immigration thing. Lots of paperwork.
Aspiras sits in the laundry room of his apartment high-rise in West Hollywood. He's wearing big dark sunglasses following a cataract surgery earlier that morning. Aspiras and thousands of other Filipino war veterans were granted U.S. citizenship in 1990 after passage of another piece of immigration legislation. His youngest daughter, now in her 50s, had no interest in joining him at the time. Aspiras says as she's gotten older and stayed in touch with friends who did come to the U.S., her attitude changed.
She was talking with friends, you know, most generous country in the world, you know, you can do anything you want. You will become to be rich, you can be rich if you want, as long as you will do it in the right way, you know.
Because of an annual per-country cap on green cards, the wait for an adult child's visa can sometimes stretch over a decade. Many Filipino war veterans worry the applications they've filed on behalf of their kids will die with them. Franco Arcibal says 20 years ago, a couple hundred guys would show up for his veteran meetings. Now he's lucky if three or four turn up.
Many have died, and many of them are invalid. They're not coming here anymore to talk. I'm the youngest. I'm 90 years old. Can you imagine that?
But under the Hirono legislation, if a veteran passes away with a visa petition already in the pipeline, the application stays alive, along with the kid's chance of coming to the U.S. That's according to Eric Lachica, executive director of the American Coalition of Filipino Veterans.
Because the little quirks of the law is that even if your parents die in your petition won't die with the veteran. It's a humanitarian waiver.
La Chica figures about 20,000 Filipino sons and daughters could be eligible if the Hirono legislation is enacted. But with so many Filipino veterans now deceased and many of their adult children possibly having little interest in coming to the U.S., isn't family reunification legislation too little, too late?
It is late, but it's not too little.
Stuart Koh is executive director of the Asian Pacific American Legal Center in Los Angeles.
The Filipino American families cherish the possibility of being reunited. It also gives some hope for the future because they may want to bring in their relatives in a legal way over a period of time. So it still is part of the American dream for many of these families.
The Filipino Veterans Family Reunification Amendment won unanimous approval from a bipartisan Senate committee last month. Now it just needs to survive what's sure to be a more fierce battle over comprehensive immigration reform. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas in Los Angeles.
Stephen snapped some great photos of the vets at the Philippine Independence Day celebration. Check them out on our website, californiareport.org.
Thank you.
The audience at classical music concerts is supposed to be seen but not heard. Even unwrapping hard candy at the wrong moment can elicit angry looks. But next weekend, a group of talented young musicians from Fresno will throw out those rules, encouraging the audience to dance, sing, and play along at the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles. From Fresno, Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin explains.
The musicians are wearing bow ties, black dresses, and looks of deep concentration as they perform a piece by Aram Khachaturian during a May concert in Fresno's Soroyan Theater. But for the last number on the program, the youth orchestras of Fresno let loose. As they burst into a mariachi-inspired score, the audience jumps in on the music-making. A mariachi group and a dancer join the young musicians on stage. The score's composer is Fresno's Ben Boone.
One of the things that I really don't like about most classical concerts is that the audience is expected to sit on their hands the entire time, to sit there and be a good receiver. But in other cultures, it's not that way. The audience are active participants.
Boone's composition is called Fresno sin Frenos, or Fresno without Breaks. The title refers to his desire to take classical scores, orchestra performers, and the audience into uncharted and maybe even dangerous territory. He does that by creating opportunities for the audience to perform within the piece.
One of my main goals in the piece is to break the fourth wall, meaning the separation that happens in Western music between the audience and the people that are on the stage. So I really wanted to involve the audience in a way that would keep the audience engaged.
Before the orchestra joins in, Boone cues school children to beat and shake instruments they made in class. Adults shake their keys or roll up their programs and beat them against their bodies. He encourages everyone to let out their best grito, or yell.
Okay, good. Now there's another rhythm that you need to know. I like chocolate cake. I like chocolate. Everyone clap.
He also teaches them the clave, a rhythmic pattern often used in Afro-Cuban and Latin music.
I want the audience to feel free to stand up and dance. I want them to, there's a place where they get to yell and just have a really good time, because isn't that what music really is about? Isn't that what really attracted everybody to music in the first place?
Boone's piece is based on Las Chapanecas, a well-known, well-loved mariachi song. The composition celebrates the Central Valley's musical heritage and Fresno's place in mariachi history. The city is home to the oldest mariachi festival in the country.
And I think this piece has a huge future as a model for other composers to write things.
Thomas Lowenheim conducts the youth orchestras of Fresno. He says the composition is pioneering a way to take popular music, transform it into classical music, and then make it fun and interactive for audience members of all ages.
I think that experience, first of all, is exciting, but even more importantly so, gives a non-musician an experience of what a musician goes through while performing. And I think that that aspect of this piece is extremely important, because then I think also appreciation for music, understanding of music, and in a way love for music will grow.
Members of the youth orchestra will perform in Los Angeles next week as part of the Fresno Opera and Orchestra Summer Academy. Audience members can join in on the fun during Ben Boone's composition. The musicians will also perform that same Khachaturian score. The two pieces are intended to highlight the Central Valley's cultural heritage.
I like to think that it says that Fresno already has this huge wealth of every kind of resource, cultural arts resources in particular.
Julia Copeland is the executive director of the Youth Orchestras of Fresno.
We're hoping that we're telling the world, you know, here we come, watch out, we're going to coming with all our talent.
Fresno sin Frenos makes its L.A. debut at the Walt Disney Concert Hall next weekend. For the California Report, I'm Rebecca Plevin in Fresno.
For some high school seniors, getting a diploma can be a real fight. And for senior Luis Torres, the fighting extends to a boxing ring. Torres attends a continuation school in Pasadena and hopes to finish up this winter. Tricia Tonko brings us his story as part of our series, Graduation Day.
It's 3 p.m. on a Wednesday, and Luis Torres trains at his neighborhood boxing gym. He comes here often, 5 days a week, for at least 2 hours each time. He conditions his body with crunches, dumbbell lifts, and push-ups. He then spars with his coach. Today he's fighting in the ring, but Luis has spent most of his teenage years fighting in the streets. He's 17 and has been in jail 4 times.
The first 3 times were for residential burglary, and the last one was for attempted residential burglary.
It was fast money. It was a lot of money. I got like $900 in one house or more in one day. And that's just one day. We'll go ahead like 3-4 houses.
At a shopping plaza near his house, Luis walks by a place he knows all too well.
We're in Pasadena City Hall. That's where I go to court at. But I've been here at this courthouse every month since, I think, 08. I've been at this courthouse. I know every floor in this courthouse, everything.
My 2 daughters, that's what made me want to change it, you know. I don't want to be a deadbeat dad to them, you know. No, I'm not trying to be in jail the rest of my life, so.
His father was never part of his life. He lives with his mother and visits his daughters once or twice a week. Luis lights up when he talks about them.
One's Kayla Darlene, the other one's Coraline Marie. The oldest is Kayla, and she's 2 years old. The youngest is Coraline, which is 7 months.
He has a large, elaborate tattoo of Kayla's name on his left arm. He says it's a symbol of the permanent effect his children have had on him. For him, boxing is not only a passion, but also an opportunity to provide for his family.
Boxers make good money when, you know, when they start coming up. So, you know, I'm going to need that couple million.
You know, he has a career if he doesn't mind getting hit.
Luis's coach, Fausto Della Torre, says the young man has a real gift.
It takes a special kind of person to get hit and continue to stay in here, to keep coming. Out of maybe 100, you get 2 guys, and he's that one. He meets that percentage.
I'm not scared to get hit. I like to go in and get hit. Or, like, when I get hit, it just turns me on, you know, like, I don't know, it just snaps. Like, something just snaps in my head to, like, protect yourself, you know. You just do what you gotta do.
When he's boxing, Luis is intensely focused. He's completely present in the moment. But thinking about what the future holds is more difficult.
I don't really think about the future. I just let it go by. Like, the days I let it go by, I don't try to think that much. I'll be getting frustrated by everything. Because I'll be like, man, I ain't got no job. What am I going to do? I got to pay rent. So I don't be trying to think that much.
School has been another source of stress for Luis. He dropped out of high school his freshman year. He says he was bored and frustrated in class. He's been going to continuation school ever since. He checks in with a teacher once a week and does most of his schoolwork at home. He says he's just going through the motions.
School doesn't interest me, like, at all. I don't have no type of, like, you know, favorite subjects or anything like that. I just go to school because I'm trying to finish school, you know. And I really don't think about none of that because I've been trying to get a job and stuff, so, like, I haven't focused on, like, what I want to be or something like that.
He's just been laid off from his graveyard shift at Denny's, and his relationship with his daughter's mother has gotten tense. He's having a hard time committing to things these days. With 4 months left of school, Luis Torres is pushing through to get his diploma. He's considering plumbing as a backup career if boxing doesn't work out. For now, he just wants to keep fighting. For his life, for his kids, and for victory itself. For the California Report, I'm Tricia Tonko in Pasadena.
That story was produced in collaboration with the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. The band known as the Mowglis was originally formed by 5 childhood pals in Southern California. As part of our series, California Songs, singer-songwriter Michael Collin describes the backstory for their song, San Francisco.
I've always been very connected with the beat poetry movement. And so the first time I came to San Francisco, I had like all these stigmas in my mind about I want to walk the same streets that Kerouac and Ginsberg and Burroughs and all these people walk. It's because when I'm there, I find poetry in everything and beauty in everything. Interesting. I feel capable of giving the most love when I'm there. For some reason, it's just like something about that city does something to me on a psychological level that is interesting, so I like to spend my time there when I can. I love walking down by the water, by the Embarcadero, and looking at the bridges. And just like it's so windy and beautiful and cleansing, I love it down there. I think the fog has this really romantic element when you're walking around and it's foggy and cold, and you know, it really helps, I guess, like cultivate interesting thoughts. I don't know, that's my experience with it. It's very beautiful. The simplicity of the song is actually part of the song itself. That's reflected probably in the fact that the music is simple. You know, it's not a complex song, and it doesn't have to be, because the love we were feeling was just so there and so easy.
That's Michael Collin from the Mowglis talking with Gina Shalaba about their song San Francisco. You can find it on their EP, Love's Not Dead. If you'd like to know the backstory of a favorite California song, let us know. CalReport@KQED.org. Next week, we're devoting a whole show to scams, focusing on rip-offs that affect people's health or healthcare, medical identity theft, fake insurance, or scams that take such an emotional toll they affect the victim's well-being. Tune in next week for that. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. Technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Rob Spate. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Rachel Marcus and Carly Nairn. Tyke Hendricks was a contributing editor. Our editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Teachers Association, celebrating 150 years of advocating for all students, educators, and California's public schools and colleges. And the California Endowment. Health happens in neighborhoods at calendow.org.